Usually, it takes years to judge whether an album is a classic. But every now and then, a record comes along and makes such an impact that you know it's going to be up there with the all-time greats. Either that, or 12 million record buyers have got it wrong. That's how many copies the album we're about to reappraise had sold at the last count. And it's still selling. Released in 1987, our classic album is Def Leppard's Hysteria. Looking back with me for the next 60 minutes is Joe Elliott.
Women was the first track that got released as a single in America. It wasn't really a single. We didn't even actually release it to Top 40 radio because there was no point. We knew it would be too heavy for them. So consequently, I think it peaked at number 80 in the Billboard chart. But it did really well on the rock stations, and consequently, by the time we got out on tour there, people really knew it, and it was going down very well, and it turned out to be like a really good live song.
How does a Def Leppard song start?
Well, actually, a song starts with some individual somewhere, anywhere in the world. I mean, it could be Phil sat on the loo in New York. It could be me sat, stood on the cop at Bramall Lane, you know, and all of a sudden something pops into your head and you think, wow, that sounds great. So you try and hum it all the way home so you don't forget it. Get it down onto some kind of tape recorder, or if it's words, pen and paper, you know. And then you have the basis of an idea. And then when you get together, you'll press your play button and they all listen to it and say, yeah, I think, you know, we can work with that, and maybe let's go for a chorus or whatever. So it sort of starts off in one person's head, and then he's kind of bashed around by the rest of the people in one room.
So was that how it was with Rocket?
Rocket started off in a sauna, believe it or not. I was in a sauna in Holland, and I heard this tape on in the background, and it was this kind of African thing, and it was just like big jungle drums, basically, but with a snare on top. And I heard it and I thought, wow, that would be such a cool rhythm to use for a rock song. And I'd never heard anybody use anything like that. So I basically put a drum loop together, of which ended up being the basis of the drum rhythm for Rocket, and just tried to come up with melodies and chords progressions and things over the top, of which the only thing that got kept really was the chorus chords. And I think it was Phil that came up with the verse and the bridge ideas. And once me, Mutt and Phil had been kind of knocking that one around for a while, we just bashed it as a band again, just bashed it around into shape.
Rocket! Yeah! Rocket, from our classic album Hysteria by Def Leppard. I'm Roger Scott. My guest is Joe Elliott, and the next track is Animal.
We had a certain backing track. The actual key and the actual block chords never changed. Neither did the melody or the lyrics, but the actual feel of the guitars changed completely. We were playing a riff, actually, most of the time through the verses, that was totally different to the way it is now, and it started to sound a little bit old-fashioned. So we decided to just completely rework the verses and just gave it a more modern feel.
Animal. And from one big hit to an even bigger one, Love Bites.
One and only number one so far. And it actually got to number 11 in England as well, which surprised me, because I always thought it's the kind of song that's not guaranteed to be a hit, but if there's ever a song likely to, it's that kind of song. And I was very surprised when it went, like, you know, into the top 15 in England. But, you know, again, it's a testament to the fact that it's a good song, really, and that there's a lot of people out there that are prepared to listen to that kind of music. It was possibly, for me, the hardest vocal I've ever sung. It took me ages to get it. It's just not in my register. It's just in a register that's very tricky for me. It's just a little bit too high for my low register, and it's a bit too low for my high register, so it's like my mid-range doesn't exist. So consequently, it was a very tricky number to do, and we couldn't really change the key because that made it sound weird on the guitars. A lot of times you can just change the key and it's no problem, but on this one in particular, it didn't sound good in other keys, so we just went with the best thing, and I just spent a long time getting it right, you know. But once I knew it, that was the funny thing, was once I knew it, I could sing it, because we do it live and it's not really a problem anymore. But it was actually learning it and trying to sing it fresh in a key that I'm just not used to singing in was very difficult. But again, it's the challenge. I actually eventually did get it done, and now I can listen to it and sometimes I still think, how the hell did I ever do that? I think we'd done all the backing tracks, and I had two or three vocals left to sing. And we were working on Armageddon at the time, and we always have an acoustic guitar in the control room of the studio, just always there, just for whatever reason. And we were just taking a tea break, and Mutt went to the loo for a pee, and I picked up the acoustic, and I just started playing the chorus, which I'd had knocking around in my head for about 3 months, but never bothered to put forward because we weren't going to write any more songs. And I was just playing it with my back to the door, not knowing that he was, you know, I was carried away so much in just playing it. He'd been back from the loo about 2 minutes, just stood in the doorway, and he was listening. And then I sort of felt the eyes burn into the back of my head, and I just sort of realised he was there, you know. And he was just stood there, and he said, "What is that?" I think he was fully expecting it to be like a Stone song or something, because I'm forever picking a guitar up and playing Angie or something like that, you know. And I said, "It's just an idea that I've had for a while." And he just turned around to me and says, "That's the biggest hook I've heard for 6 years, or whatever, since Rock of Ages even, you know, whatever it was at the time." He says, "Like, if that's not written," he says, "we've got to write it now." So we just looked at each other and started giggling and said, "Everybody's going to kill themselves if we do another song." And when the album in America was doing well. I mean, you can't say that 3.5 million albums isn't doing well, but it was doing okay. By the time Sugar came out and really kicked in, and the weather was getting good, and it's one of them kind of summery rock songs, you know, the hood down and, you know, Route 66 and all that kind of stuff. The album literally started selling like almost 1 million copies a month for the next 5 months. The whole backing track definitely took a big bow towards Get It On by T-Rex. It was that kind of 70s Stonesy T-Rex rock and roll feel. And the guitars were really chunky and chopping these little phrases out and things. And lyrics to say something like women or something would never have worked over a song like Armageddon. So, and with a title like that, it had to be slightly tongue-in-cheek, because the whole idea of it was to be a little bit humorous anyway. And you can't have an album that's just totally full of singles, otherwise it would just get pretty monotonous. I mean, I know we've got like six, in fact nearly all side one have been singles in various parts of the world, and even two tracks off side two have, I think, or maybe even three, I'm not sure now. It's Gods of Wars, to me, is an obvious album track. It's a little bit too heavy lyrically, probably, to appeal to any radio programmers to put it, you know, to put it on any playlist anyway. But it was just a song that Steve and Phil banged this one around together a lot. I think most of the idea was Steve's. It's definitely up his alley. It's that kind of semi Jimmy Page influenced sort of riffy stuff that Steve's really good at. And we, again, you know, the whole band bangs it into a song. And it was obviously one of the songs that needed a sort of a lyric a little bit more so than just a straightforward rock lyric, you know, or Jumping Jack Flash or something like that. And we've always tried to put a little bit of, not too serious, because, I mean, it's never going to go down as Shakespeare, this stuff, you know, but we just wanted to kind of go in that vein of like, well, here's something that's just got a little bit more substance to it, and there's food for thought. We fancied putting this ride out on because it sort of sounded a bit like the one on the Beatles song, She's So Heavy. So we figured, well, this is going to go... In fact, we even sang the word heavy on the end just as a nod to let everybody know, yes, we know it sounds like that a bit, you know. But it seemed a bit daft to just have this musical thing on and just let it fade and disappear. That's the way the Beatles one went, and consequently any songs that have been like that since, probably. So we wanted to just take it a stage further. So, and with the song being Gods of War, it made a lot of sense to grab a few voices. So we got Thatcher and Reagan and Gorbachev at the time. And just loads of marching noises and helicopters and guns and stuff, you know. And it's just a great effect, basically, when you hear it on headphones and things like that. It just adds a bit of sparkle towards the end of it, really.
Gods of War. And the next track on our classic album is...
Don't Shoot Shotgun. Yeah. This is probably the most straightforward rocker that we do on this album, really. It's sort of got a Stones-ish feel about it, but whenever we say that, we never, ever sound like the Stones, never could. The whole thing, when you do it in rehearsals, and if I do my Mick Jagger, you know, not my Mick Jagger, my Mick Jagger, it sounds like the Stones, but I can't sing a Mick Jagger and mean it, you know. I can do it for a laugh, but when it comes to like doing real vocals, I've got to sound like me. I just automatically go into my own voice, you know. We kind of added up the length of the songs, and we'd got like nearly 65 minutes worth of music, and so we thought, okay, well, we'll do it anyway. We figured out we could. There's no problem getting on a CD. There's no problem getting on a cassette. There was going to be a slight problem getting onto a record, but considering Queen's Greatest Hits came out in '81 and they had 59 minutes worth of music, we figured like 6 years later you could cram another 5 minutes worth on or whatever. Which we did, so there was no problem getting it pressed up. The only problem that we thought we may have was that most people's ears are trained to a 45-minute record. So we had to do something around about the 45-minute mark to wake them up. So we always figured on putting Run Riot where it was, just so when everybody's getting used to this, like, kind of, you know, well, this is good, all of a sudden, bang, you know. We wanted something a little bit noisier. Run Riot's the sort of song that's, I think I've said this before, it's like a cross between Summertime Blues and School's Out. You know, the actual way the song's put together is very much like Summertime Blues. You've got a verse just over drums and then a riff coming in and then a verse over drums and then the riff again. And lyrically, it's like a sort of a follow-up to School's Out, really. It's that, when the bell rings, let's go wherever we want to go.
And so to the title track itself, Hysteria.
Hysteria is, I don't know what it is. I like the song. It's got a good hook on. The chorus is great. I like the solo section a lot. We had a lot of problems recording this one. I remember we couldn't really figure out what to do on the chorus, and we just ended up doing the answering vocals as big as possible, just to get as many hooks in. We were inventing words again and tearing them out and putting words back in again, and then realizing they didn't exist, but they sounded good, and we ended up using, I think we used the word Mysteria, which I'm sure doesn't exist, but it sounded good.
Was Hysteria always going to be the title of the album?
No, that came... when we were in Dublin, we had two pieces of paper stuck up on a wall. And one of them said serious album titles, and the other one said stupid album titles. And of course, the serious one was blank, and the stupid one was full. But Hysteria came around, basically, Rick was just out of hospital and back to the studio. And we were just talking about the fact that we hadn't got an album title. Like, we never have an album title. You know, it's like, oh, same thing again. We just don't know what to do. They always come right at the last minute. And Rick was just sat there, you know, smoking a cigarette, and he just said, Hysteria would be a good title. And everybody just looked at him. It's like, he hadn't said a word for 2 hours, you know. He'd just been sat there, and it's like, yeah, he's right, actually. Because it just seemed to sum up at that time. It was a fair album title for what we'd been through, what we were particularly going through, and hopefully what we would go through again once the thing was out. We sang out in discos when we weren't working, and of course, all they ever played is disco music. So the way that we always think, rather than just like get annoyed about it, is try and turn a negative into a positive. And you know, we just said to each other, wouldn't it be great if we could write a song that would get played down here, yet not alienate us from our rock audience? And what we ended up with was the whole idea of the song was just like what you'd get. But we turned the guitars up too loud, you know, and we ended up with the bass drum and the snare drum were just like what we normally deal with, which is big arena kind of snare and bass drums. We did tighten the bass drum up a little bit so it didn't resonate around the place. So if it was ever played in a disco, it would work, but it would still stand out like a sore thumb. And last but not least, Love and Affection. This was one of the later ones to get recorded. We messed around with this, and we didn't bang it down as such. We did spend time on it, but not half as much time as, say, Excitable or Animal or something like that. It was a song, I should say, in all honesty, had we been recording that one earlier on, we'd have probably reworked it a little bit. But I think the song, structure-wise, is perfect and fine, and the lyrics and melody's fine and everything, but I think I would have re-sung the chorus had I got the chance. I think I sing it a lot better on the live version.
Love and Affection, the final track on Hysteria. Does Joe agree it's a classic album?
I think by the time we get to the year 2006 or whatever, maybe I could answer that question and say, well, yeah, I suppose it is, because everybody refers to it as a classic album now. I'm aware of the fact that it's a good album. I'm aware of the fact that there's good value for money. There's great recording techniques. It's a brilliant sounding record. The songs are all good. Everything about it is good. But whether that makes a classic, I think classics only come by time. I think it's a great record, and I will defend it to the hilt against any criticism. But time will tell, yeah. Time will definitely tell.
The series Classic Albums is devised and produced by Roger Scott and John Pidgeon. Our special thanks to Joe Elliott.